Hi, I'm Sanjay, and I'm a serial entrepreneur for the kicks, and I also invest in startups.
And I'm Shannon, a recent college grad working on building my first company.
And this is Startup Days,
the show where we take a behind-the-lens look at starting and growing a company from the perspective of founders and investors.
So Ned, thanks for joining us on the podcast. In case our listeners don't know who you are, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure, Ned Hill. Managing Director of Technology Banking for Square One on a full-time basis. So that's my day job. I also have a pretty extensive venture capital background. So
a secret night job.
Yeah, secret night job. Okay. So I run a small fund here in town called Service Provider Capital along with Doug Spear. And we invest in the first VC-led rounds for startups throughout the Southeast. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that. But prior to that, and I'm still involved with my venture fund in Texas called Mercury Fund. It was formerly DFJ Mercury. So we were part of the Draper Fisher Jurvetson network of
conglomerate funds. The big massive conglomerate of funds, right?
Yeah, we tended to think of it more of as a network because we're all independent funds. We raised all of our own capital. We had our own LPs. We operated independently. But it was nice. It was a common brand.
Okay.
And the brand allowed for recognition and credibility. Kind of outside the valley, right? So you can imagine.
So then the DFJ folks didn't actually get involved in kind of the day-to-day stuff?
Absolutely not. Okay. No, thankfully not.
Actually. Okay.
In fact, they were not an LP in any way. Now, Tim Draper himself, part of what he did is a lot of times he would invest in each of the funds. So Tim was an LP, and it was great to have him involved.
Yeah. And you know, there's been news that Tim has gone big on Bitcoin. Have you gone big on Bitcoin? He's apparently made a lot of money on it.
Yeah, Tim, for all of his qualities, he is bold. And so in addition to going big on Bitcoin, he did a lot of financial backing around the initiative for breaking California into six states. Not sure if you're aware of that.
I think I heard about that, yeah. Yeah. I haven't really gone anywhere, right?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't see that happening, actually. Tim is very, very bold, very much a visionary, he's eccentric as well, but obviously quite bright in what he does.
I feel like people have an issue of just adding Puerto Rico as an additional state because it'll mess up our flag. Like, I don't know what would happen if breaking up California into a bunch of states.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that would work.
Yeah. I don't know how you add five more stars.
Avoiding politics completely. What I'll say is that California could potentially do that, and there were probably about five other states that would like to secede, so maybe it would work out fine.
Maybe we'd stay at the status quo.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah. Still 50 stars is good.
So in talking about venture capital, you've been doing this for a good long while, right?
Yes, since about 2001.
Okay. So what is it about venture capital that you like? Because You left, came out of Mercury Fund, started doing Square One, and you couldn't stay away, and then you started up Service Provider Capital with right. Doug. Like, what is it that is interesting to you about it?
So, I mean, the key, and this is where a lot of entrepreneurs, I think, fall in love with innovation, creativity, and seeing kind of what it can do in the world in general. And so that's the joy. And so the question is, how do you get involved? And some people tend to do it by starting up companies. Right. I tended to do it by jumping on the finance side.
Okay.
So, I mean, my background originally, I'm actually an electrical engineer.
How are you?
Went to North Carolina State.
Same as me. I didn't know that.
I'm a Wolfpack guy. And
nice.
And I joined a startup pretty soon. It was technically my second job out of school. And it was an RTP-based, venture-funded. We went public in the early 90s. So I was an early employee there. And it, by the way, was a hardware-software company, so telecom equipment. Saw the whole model.
And you stayed there through the IPO?
Through the IPO.
Okay.
Yeah. And then, and what I saw was the financing side. So it was Excel Partners was one of the venture, and TA right. Associates was the other primary.
So good funds.
Great funds. Yeah. And obviously have done quite well. And by the way, the company was highly successful for a time. And the IPO was a terrific IPO. The company ultimately didn't kind of keep up on the technology curve, may have actually been a little ahead of itself.
Do you think that was a problem with, what do you think caused that? Was that because they went IPO, they were like then managing by quarters, or was it some leadership issue? What was the challenge there?
Yeah, because I was gone by the time it started floundering, I don't have as much insight, but I'll say that If you think about the timing, so this was a company that went public in 93. So the internet really wasn't a thing yet.
Right.
And yet we were delivering, the product was to deliver communications as well as video into the home. So we were delivering actually 3 45 megabit per second streams into each home.
Oh, wow.
Each 45 megabit per second stream was to deliver a digital video stream. So think about that for a moment. It takes 45 megabits to deliver a digital stream.
Right.
Flash forward to the world of the internet, right? What could you do with all of that bandwidth?
Yeah.
And so that was, I think, the migration or the transition that it didn't, the industry is highly regulated and it just couldn't keep up between the regulatory issues and the technology evolution. And it ultimately just wasn't the right product for the market anymore.
So it was maybe a vision issue that, hey, this is the thing that we're going to solve, but that, all these other things happen alongside of it that
I'd
maybe
say
weren't
that
for.
Plus regulatory. Our biggest customers were telcos who wanted to get into the video business.
Ah, okay.
And they would get waivers from the FCC, and ultimately it just wasn't. It became less of a priority. We were highly deployed across several of the major telcos throughout the country and in Puerto Rico. You mentioned Puerto Rico. I actually had projects down in San Juan, so that was a blast.
Nice.
But ultimately, it was no longer a priority. And then there were other technologies. DSL came along for delivering bandwidth, and that became the method by which to deliver video. And now you have over the top, and the whole method of delivering video has changed significantly.
Yeah. So coming out of that, you decided to go venture. Why didn't you do another startup?
Yeah. So the quick progression is that I saw the guys running the company all had MBAs, and I thought, well, as an engineer, I don't know much about business. Why don't I go do that? So I went to business school, and then in coming out, I had full intention of going back directly into technology, got wooed by the consulting side of the world and thought, okay, even though I have 2 years of MBA learnings, I don't really have any business experience. So I joined McKinsey coming out of school, and that seemed like a good path to continue the MBA, if you would. But wanted to get back into the world of communications. And when I left McKinsey, joined Bell South, and that was also here in Atlanta. Most of my time there was actually on the internet group, BellSouth.net at the time. I was in charge
old
of...
Old days now.
Wait, still
don't,
back.
Don't exist anymore, BellSouth. Yeah,
exactly. And so I was in charge of the broadband side of BellSouth.net. So think about, this was right as we were rolling out DSL throughout the nine-state region. And, broadband as we know it today just was emerging. And so that was also the heyday of startups. This was, again, late 90s. And I'd thought about getting into venture capital and doing the financial side to kind of pair the MBA with the love of technology. And at the end of the day, ended up getting some calls from groups that were looking for folks. And I joined a group in Texas called Stern Hill Partners. And we had a $100 million fund. That was the entry point. And, a lot of people... VC has a bit of a glow to it. I will say it's really hard work. It's hard to do it well. Sometimes the glow is unwarranted, but I get a lot of questions. Well, how did you get into VC? How do you get into VC? And there are lots of paths.
Right.
And at the end of the day, it was right place, right time with a group that was looking for somebody like me. And then once you're in, you're in.
Yeah. So compared to some of your brethren that are also venture capitalists, you've gone the route of being an entrepreneur or being early stage startup and then being a VC. Mm-hmm. A lot of other folks just are finance folks. They don't have that experience. Do you feel like there's a difference in that experience and how you relate to the entrepreneurs?
For sure. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, having been in a company where you've struggled, and I would say even then there's a difference between being a founder and being an employee, right? I mean, what I didn't have to worry about is, are we going to make payroll? Boy, I got to raise that next round.
Right.
Those are tough things to deal with. But in both cases, whether you're an early employee or a founder or neither, I do think that over time, if you're involved with startups long enough on boards and kind of in the trenches, particularly if you're an early stage investor, you can build that over time, build the experiences, because I can tell you I had a lot more experience as a VC dealing with companies that had to raise money or had to have critical hires, were running out of money. And those are things that when you go through it, even as a board member, particularly if you're intimately involved, it feels like you're part of the startup, even though, maybe you're not quite.
Right.
So I do think over time, VCs, even if they've had nothing but sort of the financial training, if they're doing early stage and they roll up their sleeves and they're intimately involved, you can build that.
Yeah.
Now, if you come in and are more of a fly-in, fly-out board member, particularly late stage, Yeah, it's different. You're probably thinking more financially, looking at the numbers more, high-level strategy, but don't have the experience of hiring people, firing people, worrying about how much capital you have and how long it's going to last. So I do think that there is a breed or there of VCs that don't have the types of experiences that entrepreneurs can really identify with.
Right.
So, you know, I like my experience set. I think it's, you know, a good balance.
So what do you think is the biggest thing in terms for entrepreneurs, like they need help on, or they don't realize they need help on, that somebody like you or anybody as an advisor could help an entrepreneur out with?
Yeah. I mean, in reality, most entrepreneurs need a lot of help.
Right.
You know, a lot of entrepreneurs.
Do you feel like most of them recognize that they need a lot of help, or are they blind to it?
No, I think so. I think probably what most entrepreneurs are blind to is the breadth of help that they really need.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, right, you know, entrepreneurs have a vision and they want to execute on that vision. And usually that's a great place to start. Now, the question is, what do you do with it? How relevant is it? I mean, and you've been through it. You know, you've got to validate that people actually like the vision that you have in mind, and you have to iterate some.
Right.
And so there is help along the way that you can get in terms of just market validation and understanding the market, making sure that there's a real need for what you're doing, that it's a hair on fire problem, not a nice to have problem. So all of that piece, you know, most entrepreneurs need some help in how to determine that. It's not that they don't know they need to determine it. It's how to do it and whether to do it. I mean, how often do you see entrepreneurs that kind of go down a path and they get way far down this path, and next thing you know, they've got something, but you know, it's a limited market opportunity, or there are big holes and gaps in what they're trying to execute on. So that is an area. And by the way, not every mentor, VC, etc., is going to be a good fit for helping you through that process. Which is why, you know, little shout out, right? You know, Prototype is a good place to do that. Any of the incubators that have resources that can help you go through that is worthwhile. I will say this, the other thing that you run into a lot is, you know, on the capitalization side, what's the right way to capitalize? How do you do it? And I think that does vary a little bit by geography, right? If you're in the Valley and you grew up in the Valley, there's a whole different mindset for how you capitalize your company versus, say, in the Southeast or specifically in Atlanta, where as we used to say at Mercury Fund, you know, money doesn't just rain down on you. You've got to figure out sort of how to be scrappy. And that scrappiness, you know, sometimes results in just naivete about, you know, when it is time to raise capital or what it can do. Or maybe, you know, what I do see a fair bit of is I don't want to raise any capital. I don't want to have other people come in. And in a lot of cases, that's right. But in some cases, you could probably benefit from having a financial partner that can bring other things to bear that you may not have to cover some of your blind spots. And by the way, can write some checks and help fund the company. But it is definitely a partnership. So
right.
You know, be careful with who you do that with.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So one of the questions then for you is, for those entrepreneurs that think they're going to raise money,
mm-hmm.
I always tell them that they need to be getting to know investors now, even though they're going to raise 12 months, 18 months from now. What do you think about that? Do you agree, disagree? And also, either way, what else should they be doing, kind of planning that one day they are going to raise money? Or, you know, even if they never raise money, like,
sure.
What are the things they should be doing?
Yeah. So in general, I do agree. It's always worthwhile to get to know people well in advance of when you think you might need them. You learn a lot of things along the way. And oh, by the way, one of them may end up being a great partner for you. The challenge, and you'll hear a lot of entrepreneurs say this, there are only so many hours in the day.
Right.
And so you do want to be careful that you're not sort of over-focusing on that. But it should be part of, as CEO, one of the most important parts of your role as CEO is making sure the company doesn't run out of money. So if you can do that without raising outside capital, then maybe it's a little bit less of your time allocation. If you think you're going to have to go down that route or you desire to go down that route, then yes, you ought to be fostering relationships, going to the types of events, getting introductions to people, having conversations that educate you on who the right type of investor is. Start to hone your thinking around bringing the right people and the right partners into your company so that it's not scramble time. You know, now I'm coming up, I have 2 months worth of cash left. You know, that's not the right time to start this conversation. So it is, you do have to prioritize based on what you think your path is going to be. But I always think it's a good idea to network you know, even if you never raise any capital, it's good to sort of hear what other smart people have to say about what you're doing.
So what do you think your rule of thumb is then, kind of, for an entrepreneur? How much runway should they have before they start thinking about raising another round?
Yeah. In my mind, you never want to have your back against the wall. So at a minimum, I sort of look at, you know, if you're 6 months away, you should be having some conversations. If you're 3 months, you better be really serious about this conversation, unless, again, you're funding it yourself or you have a way of funding it, because
so if you've got a visibility that revenue is going to ramp, or you've got a way to ramp revenue and you're not going to need that funding, then you don't need to worry about it.
Yeah, I mean, if you have the ability to self-fund, then sure, that changes your perspective a bit. You know, a lot of startups, look, if I were to say you have to start fundraising at 6 months of cash, they'd be like, all right, well, that's behind me. You know, I'm a lot closer to the end of the runway than that. And I get it. But I'm talking about once the company is kind of up and running a bit. Yeah, you just, fundraising always takes longer than people expect.
Right.
And, you know, you ought to be having conversations continually and then start getting really serious when you're within 6 months, because the challenge is that once you get inside 3 months, now it's precarious.
Right.
You know, you don't want to run out of money.
Right.
Now, if you have some existing investors that can provide a little bit additional runway, then that changes your calculus a little bit. But you do not want to run out of money. There's a famous entrepreneur back in Texas where I was that he says, you know, cash is more important than your mother, you know, and I don't know if that makes perfect sense, but it tells you just how important it is not to run out of money.
Yeah. So do you ever have kind of this desire to jump back into it, go do another startup? It's been a while now for you.
Yeah. So, I mean, the thing that I loved about a startup and the thing that I love about the entrepreneurs I work with is the camaraderie. And the reality is, whether you're a banker, an investor, a consultant, you're not really in the trenches.
Right.
And that's fun. I mean, being in the trenches is fun. Not fun every day. There are parts of it, but yes, I do feel that way. And I'll say this, you know, even though it's not the same type of startup. So, you know, I talked about joining, you know, Stern Hill Partners, $100 million fund. It was from there that I ended up hooking up with a couple of other guys that was DFJ Mercury, right?
Right.
And we went out, they had raised a small venture fund, but it was time to step up. So I helped get a first institutional fund together. So we were essentially a startup. I mean, it was kind of the three of us. Now, it was a VC startup, but it still felt, we had to figure out the phone systems. You had to figure out, you know, as you grew and hired people. Again, I won't say it's the same as a product or software focused startup, but it still felt very much like you were starting something up. And you know, that is fun. So, yes. So the short answer is I do miss it. I don't necessarily miss all of the stress every day.
Right.
Cause it can be stressful, but they're fun.
So now you're doing service provider capital with Doug Spear.
Yep.
You're on the earlier side of it cause it's a much smaller fund.
Sure.
What is it that you're looking for when you're deciding to invest in a team?
Yeah. So the interesting thing about this model is it tends to take, some or a big portion of the judgment out of it by default, right? Which is to say that we are literally looking for startups that are closing on their first VC-led round.
Okay.
And the round has to be of at least $1 million with at least $500,000 coming from the VC. And the spirit of that is that they've done diligence and we're essentially riding on the coattails of that diligence.
So you're somewhat kind of outsourcing your decision making to somebody else at that point.
Okay. And you know, the philosophy behind that is you know, what we want to be, we're not writing big checks, $50,000 to $100,000 into a company. So they're not necessarily taking our money for the capital per se. So the last thing we want to do is introduce friction. So we don't negotiate terms or docs. We just essentially go along with whatever docs that are produced as long as they don't have something egregiously bad for us. And then we try to be highly supportive of the company. So we have a broad base of LPs, and we have sister funds in Denver that invest in the Rockies, and then Chicago that invest in the Midwest. And we'll be starting up some other funds geographically. So we have a broad base of partners and LPs that we can bring to bear to hopefully add some value along the way. And so that's the model there. And the reason for that model, and the reason it's called service provider capital, is because nominally 2/3 or so of our capital come from people who are in and around the tech space. Like bankers, lawyers, commercial real estate folks, accountants, tax people. We do also have angels and VCs that are investors as well. But the notion is that we can bring a wide swath of expertise to bear for companies that could use it. And even if they never use it, we're not disruptive in any way. We know what we're doing. We're professionals. Having been a VC for sneaking up on 20 years now, I kind of know how to not cause trouble.
Probably one of the most important things for an entrepreneur in terms of what an investor does, right?
Yeah.
Not cause trouble.
Well, yeah. And then, of course, causing trouble is all in the eye of the beholder. If if a founder is floundering, then what might be perceived as causing trouble by the founder may be sort of preserving capital by the VC. But in any case, so that's the model there. You know, and the upside of it is that it gets you know, Doug and me involved in startups that are really cool and interesting, and we've made some really interesting and fun investments, some great companies so far. The downside is it is different from being a traditional VC, so we're not joining boards or anything like that.
Right.
The nice thing is I am still involved in Mercury to some extent. I'm down to one board for that company, but it's a for that firm. So. But it's a company that's based in Austin, has Silicon Valley investors. So I, you know, get out to the Valley periodically for board meetings, and our lead financial investor is Kleiner Perkins. So it's, you know, it's kind of fun to go out there and be a part of that ecosystem,
right?
And still kind of have a foot in the water of traditional VC operations.
Right. So is there so kind of last piece of advice, especially for the entrepreneurs out there? Is there one thing that they should all be doing or think about doing as they're building their startups?
Yeah, you know, it's not uncommon advice, but and the reason it's not uncommon is it's really good advice, which is to get A players involved, get people involved in your business at all levels that are incredibly talented, better than yourself type of people. That holds true for the SDRs that you're hiring. It holds true for
What's an SDR?
Yeah, sales development reps.
Oh, sales development
or BDR,
reps.
Yeah,
BDR. Business development
yeah,
reps. Okay.
SDR, BDR. And I don't mean to sort of on the totem pole have them at the bottom, because frankly
where the money comes from, right?
That's who butters the bread.
Yeah.
But those people and then build them up, train them up. But at the VP level, at the director level, when you're hiring your senior execs, and then your partners, whether it's financing partners, mentors, get people involved in the company that are top notch. Capable people, the best that you can find, because at the end of the day, that's what makes the difference. If you think about whether you're starting and running a company or whether as a VC you're investing in a company, in all likelihood, at our stage, the company is going to be different than what you originally thought. And the talent of the people to adapt and be flexible and adjust and win despite all of the obstacles that come their way, even when you have to sort of change course a bit, that's what ends up, you know, making the difference.
Right.
And so the only way you do that is to have talented people around you.
Is there something that you see or look for to identify, like, this is somebody that I want on the bus? Is there a trait? You know, do they all play basketball? Is there something that they do that you're like, oh, when you see that, you're like, oh, this is a keeper?
Well, what I was going to say is that when you talk to them, you just come away really impressed. You're like, wow, these people have vast knowledge, a diversity of experiences, have shown the ability to adapt through failures in the past and learn from them. I will say, you bring up the basketball. So I do believe that there's a correlation to people who perhaps, like, in school played sports,
right?
Just because it takes incredible discipline to allocate your time properly amongst, you know, and still graduate, particularly if you're at a good school. So I do think there's a correlation there.
Does it matter, team sports versus individual sports, or just the time allocation is the thing that matters?
I mean, team sports are good because you have to work as a team, but usually in my mind, it's just, did you excel at something that you had to work really hard at, right?
And outside of academics.
Outside of academics, and to be able to balance the time and have the discipline to make that happen. But I do think at the end of the day, you have to be careful not to get wowed by people who just kind of talk the talk. But you should walk away pretty impressed with people that you go, wow, that's somebody that offers a lot, probably offers a lot different than I bring, but has a consistent enough vision with what I want to do, that I really want to bring them in and have them on the team. And, you know, and that's, you have to interact with them and kind of test that chemistry, you know, on a one-on-one basis.
Awesome. Well, first of all, thanks a lot for being on the podcast, Ned. Is there some place that listeners can find you online?
Sure. So on Twitter, I'm at Ned Hill. That's easy.
N-E-D-H-I-L-L.
Okay. Yeah, fortunately, there aren't too many Ned Hills out there, so I was able to snag it.
Good.
Yeah, and then LinkedIn as well. So I am a prolific user of LinkedIn, and I am just Ned Hill there. And then the website for Service Provider Capital, www.serviceprovidercapital.com. And, you know, and a shout out to the fund, mercuryfund.com as well. And then my final shout out, my day job, Square One Bank. So, yeah, come see me.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Ned.
All right.